At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Three people, 1 hour, one topic. Not generally a great promo until you know the three people are named Ben, Hank, and Tim. What they saw at the financial crisis 10 years on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday today, the 19th of March. Glad to have you along, everybody. You know, there's a thing you do in radio interviews.
I'm Hank Paulson, and I was the Secretary of the Treasury.
Before you really get going.
My name is Tim Geithner. I was the Secretary of the Treasury following Hank Paulson. And before that, I ran the New York Fed.
Because you really want to get it right, right?
I'm Ben Bernanke, and I was the Chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Where you ask people how they ought to be identified. And that is, I kid you not, how I started my conversation last week with the three people who were most out front during the financial crisis 10 years ago. Once we had the IDs out of the way, we talked about the ground rules.
It occurs to me there are two Mr. Secretaries and one Mr. Chairman in this room, which is going to make for a really confusing conversation. Are we okay with Ben, Hank, and Tim?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are we? Yes. All right,
the
good.
Honorable.
The Honorable Tim?
Ben.
Okay, all right. We'll do that. Okay. And in light of that, I'm going to loosen my tie because you guys aren't wearing ties.
Loosened ties aside, the three of them were pretty relaxed, fresh off a conference at the Yale School of Management about the crisis, talking with some of the people they went through it with. The day we did this interview, by the way, last Tuesday, was the anniversary of the day the Fed helped out in the rescue of Bear Stearns, lending $29 billion to facilitate J.P. Morgan buying it. So I started with that weekend and how Ben felt about the Fed having to do something it had really never done before.
Well, I was, of course, reluctant to invoke powers that hadn't been used for many years, and I was worried about the political backlash, the effects on the Federal Reserve. But it was a decision the three of us made, and I felt very comfortable with the decision that if Bear Stearns had failed in an uncontrolled way, that it would have reverberated throughout the financial system, caused a lot of damage, and probably brought the financial crisis forward by at least 6 months.
I wonder whether you would agree with this statement, all three of you, that Bear Stearns was the moment people really started paying attention. You guys had been living with this for a long time, 18 months, 2 years, knowing it, all of you say in your books you knew it was coming. Do you think people really, it focused people's minds, Hank?
Well, it focused the public's mind in a big way.
Right.
There had been a lot of focus in the markets.
Yep.
And I believe in many ways this was one of the most impactful things that we did together. None of us debated at any length as to whether it would be a big problem if Bear Stearns had failed. We all knew that. So the question is, what should we do about it? And I would tell you the other thing is we got very lucky that weekend because we had a buyer. We came up with a buyer. And if we hadn't, as Ben said, I very strongly believe this would have accelerated everything. If Bear had gone down, Lehman would have gone down right away. We would not have yet fixed, the Fannie and Freddie,
right,
those big mortgage giants with $5.4 trillion in securities. So I think that we would have had something that would have been an order of magnitude more difficult if we hadn't taken that action.
I want to get to all that sequentially because the order in which these things happened, it's clear now 10 years later, really matters, right? But I want to ask you, Tim, something that you say in your book, that you had had a history of working with economic crises. This is what you did in the Treasury, your first go-around. You say you know what a crisis and a panic smell like. What does a crisis smell like?
it's hard to describe that in some ways the what it was really like in terms of the panic, but you know, you could hear it in people's voices when they talked to you. You know, if you talk to people in the financial system around the world at that time, people who were, you know, like in a relatively enviable position, strong, competent, smart, experienced people, you could hear in their voices for the first time in my lifetime a level of fear about the existential risk to the country, to the system, that I don't know how to capture it beyond that.
Tell me about the conversation you had with Lloyd Blankfein at one point. You guys were having a conversation.
Came later.
It was later in the crisis.
Came later.
But
yeah. I think you're just one thing about your point. You know, this thing really, the run really began in the summer of 07.
Oh, so sure it did. Absolutely.
And I think even though Bear was terrifically scary and hugely important, I think even after Bear, it took a while, and I don't think really people felt until September. But
well,
I remember talking to him on the phone one morning.
Lloyd, yeah.
Yeah, and he, you know, you just got to hear in his voice. And we talked about what we had to talk about, and then we got off the phone, and I called him back and said, don't let anybody else hear that in your voice. Don't get on the phone with anybody else until you get that sense of fear and anxiety out of your voice.
As we were dividing up and figuring out who was going to do what, because I knew so many of the players on Wall Street,
right.
I got out and made some calls. And I remember getting Joe Ackerman, who was the chairman and CEO of Deutsche Bank. And he was in New York City when I found him and got him on the phone to see if they might have any interest in investing in Bear Stearns and in buying Bear Stearns. And the fear in his voice, and he said, oh my gosh, and buy them. No, the question is, why should I do anything with any U.S. investment bank? And this had been rippling on for some time.
Yeah. Ben, go ahead. You were going to say something?
No, I was just going to say that, you know, a panic is an emotional state, but it's also an observable thing, which is money running away. Yeah. You know, nobody wants to lend money on a short-term basis. And in Bear Stearns' case, their short-term borrowing, the short-term funding was just running. And it was clear that if we didn't arrest that situation, it was going to spread to other companies as well.
I don't want to get too deep into the nuts and bolts of this thing, but all three of you talk about the short-term lending market and repo and overnight and how critical all that was and how that just vaporized. And I wonder if we were set up by our very financial infrastructure to have this happen.
Well, you've made the key point, which is we had a financial infrastructure that had been put in place years earlier, and then we'd had a financial system that had developed and really outgrown the regulatory authorities we needed to manage it. We didn't have the transparency you needed into the system. It was incredibly complex. We had a very big, you said, the repo market, which I would describe as a secured interbank lending market, which was several trillion dollars. And so this was clearly a case where we had a balkanized, outdated regulatory system. And so that's what we were dealing with throughout this thing. We were dealing with trying to put out a fire without the right tools to do so.
You don't talk to those three guys for an hour and then only put 6 minutes on the air, right? More Ben, Tim, and Hank coming up later on in the program. Let me tell you, were this any other day, Facebook and the rough day in the markets would have probably been a whole lot closer to the top of the program. Facebook is coming up. Wall Street, well, yeah, rough is one word for it. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The number of the day today is 6.77. It's denominated in percentages, and it's how far Facebook shares dropped on the big news from the weekend that a company called Cambridge Analytica hoovered up data and information belonging to 50 million Facebook users and used it to help aim political messages favorable to Donald Trump at otherwise unsuspecting voters. Members of Congress are calling for CEO Mark Zuckerberg to spend some time at the Long Green witness table explaining himself. And those who want more regulation of tech and social media companies are thinking they are now going to be able to get some traction. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looks at the intersection of those regulations and Facebook's business model.
When it comes to regulating tech, I'll let Vivek Krishnamurthy explain. He's an attorney at the Cyber Law Clinic at Harvard.
In the United States, we have very, very weak to non-existent data privacy laws at the federal and state level, at least compared to the rest of the world.
But there is some oversight. Facebook has been operating under a consent order since 2012, part of a settlement with the FTC. It required the company to improve its privacy and data sharing protocols. Jessica Rich oversaw the development of that order and now leads advocacy efforts at Consumer Reports. She says of the Cambridge Analytica scandal,
"My gut is telling me there are serious problems here. In looking back and reminding myself of what was in the order, I see numerous possibilities."
And those problems could be used to make a stronger case for more regulation. Nuala O'Connor is president of the Center for Democracy and Technology. She says new legislation could potentially include
some basic rules about letting the individual know what data is being collected, making sure that the data collected is kept safe, and being really clear when it's going to be shared with other parties.
More rules could make Facebook's users feel better, but might threaten Facebook's business model, selling our information to those who want to sell things to us. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
I know there's been a lot of non-economy news since Friday, but let's get back to tariffs here for a second, if we could. President Trump's duties on steel and aluminum, 25 and 10%, remember, are set to take effect on Friday. And as of this morning, companies were allowed to start applying for exemptions to those tariffs. The Commerce Department published its exemption criteria this weekend because new tariffs, new paperwork, right? And as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, there is still a whole lot of scrambling going on.
Jim McGreevy's first question is who can apply for an exemption? He's president of the Beer Institute, a trade group. Lots of beer, of course, comes in aluminum cans.
It's not clear whether trade associations or even individual brewers can file a petition for exclusion, but we're still trying to figure out what the guidance really says.
That means calls to trade lawyers like Gregory Hussisian with Foley and Lardner. He says only U.S. individuals or organizations using steel and aluminum in business activities can apply. So it looks like trade groups, as well as foreign firms, are out. Next step, companies have to prove that they need steel for national security, or that they can't get it or get enough of it from a domestic producer. Simple sounding, says Hussisian, but
nobody knows how strict the U.S. government is going to be. For example, it may be that if the U.S. industry makes something that's sort of similar, but it would require the purchaser to adapt how they make goods, is that close enough?
And when it comes to countries or trading blocks like the European Union,
there is not a precise procedure which has been set up and made publicly known.
David O'Sullivan is the EU ambassador to the U.S.
So we are simply in a kind of informal process of dialogue and exchange of views.
The EU's trade commissioner heads to Washington tomorrow to make the case that EU steel exports are typically specialized, high quality, and not a threat to U.S. national security. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we were using duct tape and string to try to hold a thing together.
More from Ben, Tim, and Hank straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here you go. The Wawa's on a Monday. The Dow Industrial's off 335 points, 1.3%, closed at 24,610. It was worse mid-session, by the by. The NASDAQ off 137 points, about 1.8%. 73.44. The S&P 500 down 39 points, 1.4%, 27-12. As we mentioned, tech stocks down. Hello, Facebook. Twitter shed 1.6%. Google parent Alphabet clicked down about 3% today. Mentioned domestic companies like beer brewers that sell their wares in aluminum cans are trying to figure out whether they can apply for exemptions from the tariffs. Anheuser-Busch InBev lost more than 0.5% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up just a touch, 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
right
room
now.
We're not, where it happens.
We're not.
How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back now to the hour we spent talking about the financial crisis last Tuesday. Me and Ben Bernanke, then the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, and Tim Geithner, then the president of the New York Fed. We left off up at the top of the program in March of 2008 and the Fed helping save Bear Stearns. The through line in a phrase was creativity in the face of crisis from those three, and the feeling that all of them had that they didn't actually have the authority to do a lot of what they thought was necessary to calm things down. So I asked them whether maybe they were able to get things done on the fly so much because the rules and regulations of the financial system were so weak and fractured. Tim Geithner was not having that.
Until President Bush and Hank Paulson were successful in getting Congress to pass the emergency authority in September, early October, we were using duct tape and string to try to hold a thing together. We were doing so creatively in ways that hadn't been done since the Great Depression, but those tools were very weak, and the capacity to maximize their power was very limited against the force of the storm. When they were successful in getting more authority for the country, yeah, to protect the country from the failing financial system, at that point we were able to do really extraordinary, dramatic things. And I think that the absence of those tools at the beginning and the degrees of freedom you had and the relative balkanization of the authorities,
right,
was a major factor in why this crisis was so bad, huh, and why the damage to the economy was so great. I think it was a terrible handicap going into this.
And the apex of the crisis hit on the margins of a national election.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a clash between politics and economics. But one of the things that Tim got to here was we all knew quite early on we would like to have authorities to do things we didn't have. So the question was, how did you get those from Congress? I don't think any of us believe we had any chance of getting the authorities any earlier than we got them, but that was sort of what we were living with, working with the authorities we had, inadequate as they were, and making do with them to sort of hold the system together until we could get to Congress and get the authorities we needed.
Ben, you make a point of wanting to stay out of the politics of this thing to preserve the Fed's independence. But you spent no small amount of time schlepping up to the Hill and talking to Congress members and laying stuff out for them.
Well, that's part of the accountability. The Federal Reserve is a government agency. It is acting on behalf of the people. Its leadership, including me, is appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but is not elected. And so it's very important that we do all we could to explain what we were doing, why we were doing it, not only because of democratic accountability, as important as that is, but also to try to allay the fear to some extent and try to convince people that we were, in fact, responding to the situation.
When do you think Congress started to hear you on that?
Well, they, you know, they certainly responded to Bear Stearns.
Hank, I mean, you're laughing. What?
Yeah, well, it took a while. I mean, I think the most important early success, and Hank can speak to it, was Hank's ability to get the ability to respond to the Fannie and Freddie situation.
So that's what we call a great cue in radio. I'm going to play you a piece of tape, Hank, and then I want to talk to you about it.
If you've got a squirt gun in your pocket, you may have to take it out. If you've got a bazooka and people know you've got it, you may not have to take it out. You're not likely to take it out.
So Hank's laughing. Tim's kind of smiling, going, yeah. So this is you in front of Congress July 2008 saying, listen, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are structural and systemic problems.
Right. So as I look back at it, I would say that one of the things I'm most grateful for are the two biggest mistakes I was part of. Hmm. We corrected right there on the battlefield and we reversed ourselves. So let's take Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah.
So it illustrates two things. First of all, Ben is being modest. So you have – it's very unusual, I think, that we had a chairman of the Fed that had the political skills that Ben had and the courage that he had, because when I was up there working to get the authorities from Congress, there was no way we had any chance of getting him, in my judgment, if Ben hadn't been right up there – two of us together. And then when we ultimately moved to put Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship or to nationalize them, Ben was side by side. But to get to the mistake in correcting myself, that there was no way we would ever have gotten the authorities to nationalize Fannie and Freddie if we'd gone to the Hill and said, guess what? We want to nationalize Fannie and Freddie. Now, fortunately for me, I didn't believe it was going to be necessary. We didn't have all of the information we needed. We couldn't ask for unlimited authorities, so we asked for unspecified. And so that was what I was saying. So we got unspecified authorities. So I thought, so I used example. If
you guys are smiling as you talk.
Unspecified authorities, you won't have to use them. But so when the situation changed, and of course Congress only gave us the authority to put capital in on terms that Fannie and Freddie accepted. So what we did was something that Congress hadn't contemplated. We got the ability to have a safety and soundness regulator for the Fed, for Fannie and Freddie, that could make the kinds of judgments regulators normally make, and to have the Fed also be a consultative regulator. And so we changed and reversed course.
On the fly.
On the fly.
Tim, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, it just illustrates something important for people to understand, which is these things happen. They can happen really quickly. They're very hard to understand in the moment. There's huge fog, uncertainty around them. You need the ability to adapt and move quickly and to change your mind. And although bazooka may not be the – I mean, another thing about these – about runs like this is to – stop a panic, protect people from a panic. You have to be able to deploy a level of force that is dramatically large relative to the problem so that you can reassure people that if they stay and don't run, they'll be safe in that kind of
situation. So you know what's interesting about this whole exchange is that the through line of your recounting of this in your book is very heavily on the war metaphors and how you specifically thought you were at war. And there's a great scene where you go to see Hurt Locker and you now finally have somebody who you can identify with, and that's what it felt like, defusing these bombs. If you were at war, who was the enemy?
It's a good, subtle question. The enemy was the fear and the loss of confidence and the sense of no bottom, no foundation. And the enemy was the perception that the safest thing you could do as a depositor in a bank or as a lender to somebody or as a businessman or something like that is to rush for the exits to protect yourself against the harm to come. And the collective, that's maybe rational individually, but the way panics work is the collective damage that rational behavior the individual causes mm-hmm. is the deep existential threat to the country. And so the scary thing is to figure out how you break that spiral, how you can alter the incentives, how you convince people that we can put a floor under things so they can get back to the business of trying to make their business work and hire people.
I was going to say, George Bush used that analogy a lot. And I would say, I think he was a terrific wartime commander. And so
economic wartime.
Economic. So that's my point. And so that's a big distinction. And so he would say to me, you guys are wartime general. I'm looking at you as a wartime general. Now, we recognize we weren't landing at Omaha Beach with bullets flying over our head.
Metaphorically.
But when we talked about this, George Bush would talk about this, and we would talk about it among ourselves. So who was the enemy? We always used I would always use the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Who are these guys? They just keep coming, and and what he would always say, is this enough dynamite? Is there enough force to stop this after every time?
So we don't want this metaphor to go too far. People ask me, how did you deal with the stress? And there was a lot of stress, but I responded to the person. They said, well, at least I'm not a grunt in Iraq, worrying about IEDs. This is Tim's way of it, talking about, the stress and the fact that the basic fact, as someone once said, was that your war plan disappears the first
doesn't survive contact with the enemy. Right.
As soon as you meet the enemy, and that's essentially where we were. I mean, we had all kinds of plans and white papers and memos, and then of course we had contact with this enemy, and a lot of those plans needed very radical, rapid revision.
We are going to run another couple of segments from that interview the next couple of days. Tomorrow, Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, and Tim Geithner, and Lehman Brothers Weekend, September of 2008. In the meanwhile, we've got the transcript of the whole thing online, as well as all the rest of our coverage of this crisis and the 10 years since. It's called Divided Decade, and it lives online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a little bit more of what really happens before you get down to it in a big interview. We had been told that Ben Bernanke didn't have a lot of time to stick around after we were done. He had to catch a flight to Nashville, it seems. So I asked him what was in Nashville.
I am the incoming president of the American Economic Association.
Oh, are you?
Yes. And the AEA's headquarters are there at Vanderbilt.
Is that a good thing to be an incoming president of the AEA?
I volunteered, so yeah, I think it's cool. I mean,
Tim Geithner, though, wanted to know what Bernanke would do if he really had his druthers.
Would you rather be baseball commissioner?
I would rather be baseball commissioner. That job is now taken, unfortunately.
More tomorrow from Hank, Tim, and Ben on the financial crisis 10 years later. All right, we're done. A little bit ugly on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials off 335. That's 1.3%. NASDAQ down 137, 1.8%. S&P 500 off 39 points, 1.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.